and by her bed. She said she kept sewing notions in it, but I... Nate took a deep breath, looking at Tessa as he spoke. I was in debt. I'd made a few rash bets, had lost some money, and I was in a bad way. I didn't want you or Aunt to know. I remembered there was a gold bracelet Mother used to wear when she was alive. I got it into my head that it was still in that jewelry box and that Aunt Harriet was just too stubborn to sell it. You know how she is, how she was. Anyway, I couldn't let the idea go. I knew that if I could pawn the bracelet, I could get the money to pay off my debts. So one day when you and Aunt were out, I got hold of the box and searched it. Of course, the bracelet wasn't in it, but I did find a false bottom to the case. There was nothing in it of any worth, just a wadded-up bunch of old papers. I snatched them when I heard you coming up the stairs and took them back to my room. Nate paused. All eyes were on him. After a moment, Tessa, no longer able to hold her questions in, said, "And?" "They were Mother's diary pages," Nate said, "torn out of their original binding with quite a few missing, but it was enough for me to put together a strange story. It began when our parents were living in London. Father was gone often, working in Mortmain's offices down at the docks, but Mother had Aunt Harriet to keep her company and me to keep her occupied. I had just been born. That was until Father began to come home night after night increasingly distressed. He reported odd doings on the factory floor, bits of machinery malfunctioning in strange ways, noises heard at all hours, and even the night watchman gone missing one night. There were rumors, too, that Mortmain was involved in occult practices." Nate sounded as if he were remembering as much as reciting the tale. "Father shrugged the rumors off at first, but eventually repeated them to Mortmain, who admitted everything. I gather he managed to make it sound rather harmless, as if he were just having a bit of a lark with spells and pentagrams and things. He called the organization he belonged to the Pandemonium Club. He suggested that Father come to one of their meetings and bring Mother."
"Bring Mother? But he couldn't possibly have wanted to do that."
"Probably not, but with a new wife and a new baby, Father would have been eager to please his employer. He agreed to go and to bring Mother with him."
"Father should have gone to the police."
"A rich man like Mortmain would have had the police in his pocket," interrupted Will. "Had your father gone to the police, they would have laughed at him."
Nathaniel pushed the hair back off his forehead. He was sweating now, strands of hair sticking to his skin.
"Mortmain arranged a carriage to come for both of them late at night when no one would be watching. The carriage brought them to Mortmain's townhouse. After that, there were many missing pages and no details about what happened that night. It was the first time they went, but not, I learned, the last. They met with the Pandemonium Club several times over the course of the next few months. Mother at least hated going, but they continued to attend the meetings until something changed abruptly. I don't know what it was. There were few pages after that. I was able to discern that when they left London, they did it under cover of night, that they told no one where they were going, and they left no forwarding address. They might as well have vanished. Nothing in the diary, though, said anything about why."
Nathaniel broke off his story with a fit of dry coughing. Jessamine scrambled for the tea that Sophie had left on the side table, and a moment later was pressing a cup into Nate's hand. She gave Tessa a superior expression as she did so, as if to point out that Tessa really ought to have thought of it first. Nate, having quieted his coughing with tea, continued, "Having found the diary pages, I felt as if I'd stumbled across a gold mine. I'd heard of Mortmain. I knew the man was as rich as Croesus, even if he was evidently a bit mad. I wrote to him and told him I was Nathaniel Gray, the son of Richard and Elizabeth Gray, that my father was dead, and so was my mother, and in among her papers I had found evidence of his occult activities. I intimated that I was eager to meet him and discuss possible employment, and that if he proved less eager to meet me, there were several newspapers that I imagined would be interested in my mother's diary." "That was enterprising." Will sounded nearly impressed. Nate smiled. Tessa shot him a furious look. "Don't look pleased with yourself. When Will says enterprising, he means morally deficient."
"No, I mean enterprising," said Will. When I mean morally deficient, I say, now, that's something I would have done.
That's enough, Will, Charlotte interrupted. Let Mr. Gray finish his story.
I thought perhaps he'd send me a bribe, some money to shut me up, Nate went on. Instead, I got a first-class steamer ticket to London and the official offer of a job once I arrived. I figured I was onto a good thing, and for the first time in my life, I didn't plan on messing it up. When I got to London, I went straight to Mortmain's house, where I was ushered into the study to meet him. He greeted me with great warmth, telling me how glad he was to see me and how I looked just like my dear dead mother. Then he grew serious. He sat me down and told me he had always liked my parents and had been saddened when they left England. He had not known they were dead until he received my letter. Even if I were to go public with what I knew about him, he claimed he would happily give me a job and do whatever he could for me, for my parents' sake. I told Mortmain that I would keep his secret if he brought me with him to attend a meeting of the Pandemonium Club, that he owed it to me to show me what it was he had shown my parents. The truth was, the mentioning of gambling in my mother's diary had sparked my interest. I imagined a meeting of a group of men silly enough to believe in magic and devils. Surely it wouldn't be difficult to win a bit of money off such fools. Nate closed his eyes. Mortmain agreed, reluctantly, to take me. I suppose he had no choice. That night the meeting was at De Quincey's townhouse. The moment the door opened, I knew I was a fool. This was no group of amateurs dabbling in spiritualism. This was the real thing, the shadow world my mother had made only glancing reference to in her diary. It was real. I can barely describe my sense of shock as I stared around me. Creatures of indescribable grotesqueness filled the room. The Dark Sisters were there, leering at me from behind their whist cards, their nails like talons. Women with their faces and shoulders powdered white smiled at me with blood running out the corners of their mouths. Little creatures whose eyes changed color scuttled across the floor. I had never imagined such things were real, and I said as much to Mortmain. There are more things in heaven and earth, Nathaniel, than are dreamt of in your philosophy, he said. Well, I knew the quote because of you, Tessa. You were always reading Shakespeare at me, and I even paid attention some of the time. I was about to tell Mortmain not to make fun of me when a man came up to us. I saw Mortmain go stiff as a board, as if this were someone he was frightened of. He introduced me as Nathaniel, a new employee, and told me the man's name, De Quincey. De Quincey smiled. I knew immediately he wasn't human. I'd never seen a vampire before, with that death-white skin of theirs, and of course when he smiled, I saw his teeth. I think I just stared. Mortmain, you're keeping things from me again, he said. This is more than just a new employee. This is Nathaniel Gray, Elizabeth and Richard Gray's son. Mortmain stammered something, looking baffled. De Quincey chuckled. I do hear things, Axel, he said. Then he turned to me. I knew your father, he told me. I liked him quite a bit. Perhaps you'd join me for a game of cards. Mortmain shook his head at me. But I'd seen the card room when I'd come into the house, of course. I was drawn to the gaming tables like a moth to light. I sat playing Pharaoh all night with a vampire, two werewolves, and a wild-haired warlock. I made my jack that night, won a great deal of money, and drank a great deal of the colorful, sparkling drinks that were passed around the room on silver trays. At some point Mortmain left, but I didn't care. I emerged in the dawn light feeling exultant on top of the world and with an invitation from De Quincey to return to the club whenever I liked. I was a fool, of course. I was having such a high old time of it because the drinks were mixed with warlock potions, addictive ones, and I had been allowed to win that evening. I went back, of course, without Mortmain, night after night. At first I won. Won steadily, which was how I was able to send money back to you and Aunt Harriet, Tessie. It certainly wasn't from working at Mortmain's. I went into the office irregularly, but I could barely concentrate even on the simple tasks I was assigned. All I thought about was getting back to the club, drinking more of those drinks, winning more money. Then I started to lose. The more I lost, the more obsessed I became with winning it back. De Quincey suggested I start playing on tick, so I borrowed money. I stopped coming into the office at all. I slept all day and gambled all night. I lost everything. His voice was remote. When I got your letter that Aunt had died, Tessa, I thought it was a judgment on me, a punishment for my behavior. I wanted to rush out and buy a ticket to return to New York that day, but I had no money. Desperate, I went to the club. I was unshaved, miserable, red-eyed. I must have looked like a man at his lowest ebb, because it was then that De Quincey approached me with a proposition. He drew me into a back room and pointed out that I had lost more money to the club than any one man could ever pay back. He seemed amused by it all, the devil flicking invisible dust off his cuffs, grinning at me with those needle teeth. He asked me what I'd be willing to give to pay off my debts. I said anything, and he said, "What about your sister?" Tessa felt the hairs on her arms rise and was uncomfortably aware of the eyes of everyone in the room on her. What did he say about me?
I was utterly taken off guard, said Nate. I didn't recall having discussed you with him ever, but I had been drunk so many times at the club and we had spoken very freely. The teacup in his hand rattled in its saucer. He set them both down hard. I asked him what he could possibly want with my sister. He told me that he had reason to know that one of my mother's children was special. He had thought it might be me, but having had leisure to observe me, the only thing unusual about me was my foolishness. Nate's tone was bitter. But your sister is something else again, he told me. She has all the power you do not. I have no intention of harming her. She is far too important. I spluttered and begged for more information, but he was unyielding. Either I procured Tessa for him or I would die. He even told me what it was I had to do. Tessa exhaled slowly.
De Quincey told you to write me that letter, she said. He had you send me the tickets for the Maine. He had you bring me here.
Nate's eyes pleaded with her to understand.
He swore he wouldn't hurt you. He told me all he wanted was to teach you to use your power. He told me you'd be honored and wealthy beyond imagining.
Well, that's just fine, then, interrupted Will. It's not as if there are more important things than money. His eyes were blazing with indignation. Jem looked no less disgusted.
It's not Nate's fault, Jessamine snapped. Didn't you hear him? De Quincey would have killed him, and he knew who Nate was, where he came from. He would have found Tessa eventually anyway, and Nate would have died for no reason.
So that's your objective ethical opinion, is it, Jess? Will said. And I suppose it has nothing to do with the fact that you've been drooling over Tessa's brother since he arrived. Any mundane will do, I suppose, no matter how useless.
Jessamine let out an indignant squawk and rose to her feet. Charlotte, her voice rising, tried to quiet them both as they shouted at each other. But Tessa had stopped listening. She was looking at Nate. She had known for some time her brother was weak, that what her aunt had called innocence was really spoiled, pettish childishness, that being a boy, the firstborn and beautiful, Nate had always been the prince of his own tiny kingdom. She had understood that, while it had always been his job as older brother to protect her, really it had always been she and her aunt who had protected him. But he was her brother. She loved him, and the old protectiveness rose in her, as it always did where Nate was concerned, and probably always would.
"Jessamine's right," she said, raising her voice to cut through the angry voices in the room. "It wouldn't have done him any good to refuse De Quincey, and there's no point arguing about it now. We still need to know what De Quincey's plans are. Do you know, Nate? Did he tell you what he wanted with me?"
Nate shook his head. "Once I agreed to send for you, he kept me trapped in his townhouse. He had me send a letter to Mortmain, of course, resigning from his employment.
The poor man must have thought I was throwing his generosity back in his face. De Quincey wasn't planning on taking his eyes off me until he had you in hand, Tessie. I was his insurance. He gave the Dark Sisters my ring to prove to you that I was in their power. He promised me over and over that he wouldn't hurt you, that he was simply having the sisters teach you to use your power. The Dark Sisters reported on your progress every day, so I knew you were still alive. Since I was there in the house anyway, I found myself observing the workings of the Pandemonium Club. I saw that there was an organization to the ranks. There were those who were very low down, clinging to the fringes, like Mortmain and his ilk. De Quincey and the higher-ups mostly kept them around because they had money, and they teased them with little glimpses of magic and the shadow world to keep them coming back for more. Then there were those such as the Dark Sisters and others, those who had more power and responsibility in the club. They were all supernatural creatures, no humans. And then at the top was De Quincey. The others called him the Magister. They often held meetings to which the humans and those lower down weren't invited. That was where I first heard about shadow hunters. De Quincey despises shadow hunters, Nate said, turning to Henry and Charlotte. He has a grudge against them, against you. He kept talking about how much better things would be when shadow hunters were destroyed and downworlders could live and trade in peace.
What tosh? Henry looked genuinely offended. Don't know what kind of peace he thinks there'd be without shadow hunters.
He talked about how there'd never been a way to defeat shadow hunters before because their weapons were so superior. He said the legend was that God had meant the Nephilim to be superior warriors, so no living creature could destroy them. So apparently De Quincey thought, why not a creature who wasn't living at all?
The automatons, said Charlotte. His machine army.
Nate looked puzzled.
You've seen them?
A few of them attacked your sister last night, said Will. Fortunately, we shadow hunter monsters were around to save her.
Not that she was doing too badly by herself, Jem murmured. Do you know anything about the machines? Charlotte demanded, leaning forward eagerly. Anything at all? Did De Quincey ever talk about them in front of you?
Nate shrank back in his chair. He did, but I didn't understand most of it. I don't have a mechanical mind, really.
It's simple,
it was Henry using the tone of someone trying to calm a frightened cat.
Right now, these machines of De Quincey's just run on mechanisms. They have to be wound up like clocks. But we found a copy of a spell in his library that indicates that he's trying to find a way to make them live, a way to bind demon energy to the clockwork shell and bring it to life.
Oh, that? Yes, he talked about that, Nate replied, like a child pleased to be able to give the right answer in a schoolroom.
Tessa could practically see the ears of the shadow hunters pricking up with excitement. This was what they really wanted to know.
That's what he hired the Dark Sisters for, not just for training Tessa. They're warlocks, you know, and they were meant to be figuring out how it could be done. And they did. It wasn't long ago, a few weeks, but they did.
They did? Charlotte looked shocked. But then why hasn't De Quincey done it yet? What's he waiting for?
Nate looked from her anxious face to Tessa's and all around the room.
I thought you knew. He said the binding charm could only be generated at the full moon. When that happens, the Dark Sisters will get to work, and then he's got dozens of the things stored in his hideaway, and I know he plans to make many more, hundreds, thousands, perhaps. I suppose he'll animate them and...
The full moon?
Charlotte, glancing toward the window, bit her lip.
That will be very soon. Tomorrow night, I think.
Jem straightened up like a shot. I can check the lunar tables in the library. I'll be right back. He vanished through the door. Charlotte turned to Nate.
You're quite sure about this?
Nate nodded, swallowing hard.
When Tessa escaped from the Dark Sisters, De Quincey blamed me, even though I hadn't known anything about it. He told me he was going to let the Night Children drain my blood as a punishment. He kept me imprisoned for days before the party. He didn't care what he said in front of me then. He He knew I was going to die. I heard him talking about how the sisters had mastered the binding spell, that it wasn't going to be long before the Nephilim were destroyed and all the members of the Pandemonium Club could rule London in their stead. Will spoke, his voice harsh. Have you any idea where De Quincey might be hiding now that his house is burned? Nate looked exhausted. He has a hideaway in Chelsea. He would have gone to ground there with those who were loyal to him. There are still probably 100 vampires of his clan who weren't at the townhouse that night. I know exactly where the place is. I can show you on a map. He broke off as Jem burst into the room, his eyes very wide. It's not tomorrow, Jem said. The full moon. It's tonight. 17. Call the darkness down. The old church tower and garden wall are black with autumn rain, and dreary winds foreboding call the darkness down again. Emily Bronte, The Old Church Tower. While Charlotte dashed to the library to notify the enclave that emergency action would need to be taken that evening, Henry remained in the drawing room with Nathaniel and the others. He was surprisingly patient as Nate painstakingly indicated on a map of London the spot where he believed De Quincey's hideaway to be, a house in Chelsea near the Thames. "I don't know which one it is exactly," Nate said, "so you'll have to be careful." "We are always careful," Henry said, ignoring Will's wry look in his direction. Not long after that, however, he sent Will and Jem to the weapons room with Thomas to ready a stock of serif blades and other armaments. Tessa remained in the drawing room with Jessamine and Nate while Henry hurried off to the crypt to retrieve some of his more recent inventions. As soon as the others had gone, Jessamine commenced fluttering around Nate, building up the fire for him, going to fetch another blanket to wrap around his shoulders, and offering to find a book to read aloud to him, which he declined. If Jessamine was hoping to win Nate's heart by fussing over him, Tessa thought, she would be in for a disappointment. Nate expected to be fussed over and would hardly notice her special attentions. "So what's going to happen now?" he asked finally, half buried under a mound of blankets. "Mr. and Mrs. Branwell."
"Oh, call them Henry and Charlotte. Everyone does," Jessamine said.
"They'll be notifying the Enclave. That's all the rest of London's shadow hunters, of the location of De Quincey's hideaway so they can plan an attack," said Tessa. "But really, Nate, you shouldn't be worrying about these things. You should be resting."
"So it'll just be us."
Nate's eyes were closed.
"In this big old place. Seems strange."
"Oh, Will and Jem won't be going with them," said Jessamine. "I heard her talking to them in the weapons room when I went to get the blanket."
Nate's eyes opened.
"They won't?"
He sounded astonished.
"Why not?"
"They're too young," said Jessamine. "Shadow hunters are considered adults at 18, and for this kind of undertaking, something dangerous that the whole enclave is participating in, they tend to leave the younger ones at home."
Tessa felt a strange little pang of relief, which she covered by asking hurriedly, "But that's so odd. They let Will and Jem go to De Quincey's."
"And that's why they can't go now. Apparently Benedict Lightwood is arguing that the raid on De Quincey's turned out as badly as it did because Will and Jem are insufficiently trained, though how any of it was meant to be Jem's fault, I'm not sure. If you ask me, he wants an excuse to make Gabriel stay at home, even though he's already 18. He babies him horribly. Charlotte said he told her that there have been whole enclaves wiped out in a single night before, and the Nephilim have an obligation to leave the younger generation standing, to carry on, as it were."
Tessa's stomach twisted. Before she could say anything, the door opened and Thomas came in. He was carrying a stack of folded clothes.
"These are old things of Master Jem's," he said to Nate, looking slightly embarrassed. "It looks like you might be about the same size, and, well, you ought to have something to wear. If you'll accompany me back to your room, we can see if they fit."
Jessamine rolled her eyes. Tessa wasn't sure why. Perhaps she thought cast-offs weren't good enough for Nate.
Thank you, Thomas, Nate said, rising to his feet. And I must tender my apologies for my earlier behavior when I, hid from you. I must have been feverish, that's the only explanation.
Thomas flushed.
Just doing my job, sir.
Perhaps you should get some sleep, Tessa said, noting the dark rings of exhaustion around her brother's eyes. There won't be much for us to do now, not until they return.
Actually, Nate said, looking from Jessamine to Tessa, I think I've had enough of rest. A fellow ought to get back on his feet eventually, oughtn't he? I could stand to eat a bite of something, and I wouldn't mind some company. If you wouldn't mind my joining you here once I'm dressed.
Of course not, Jessamine looked delighted. I'll ask Agatha to prepare something light, and perhaps a game of cards to keep us occupied after we eat. Sandwiches and tea, I think.
She clapped her hands together as Thomas and Nate left the room and turned to Tessa, her eyes bright.
Won't that be fun?
Cards?
Tessa, who had been shocked nearly speechless by Jessamine's suggestion, found her voice. You think we ought to play cards while Henry and Charlotte are off fighting De Quincey? Jessamine tossed her head.
As if our moping around would help them. I'm sure they'd rather we were cheerful and active in their absence rather than idle and morose.
Tessa frowned. I really don't think, she said, that suggesting cards to Nate was a kind idea, Jessamine. You know perfectly well he has trouble with gambling.
We're not going to gamble, Jessamine said airily. Just a friendly game of cards, really, Tessa. Must you be such a wet blanket?
A what? Jessamine, I know you're only trying to keep Nate happy, but this isn't the way.
And I suppose you've mastered the art of winning men's affections?
Jessamine snapped, her brown eyes sparkling with anger.
You think I haven't seen you looking at Will with puppy dog eyes? As if you were even... Oh!
She threw up her hands.
Never mind, you make me sick. I'm going to talk to Agatha without you.
With that, she rose to her feet and flounced out of the room, pausing in the doorway only to say,
And I know you don't care how you look, but you ought to at least fix your hair, Tessa. It looks like birds are living in it.
Before the door slammed shut behind her. Silly as Tessa knew it was, Jessamine's words stung. She hastened back to her room to splash water on her face and run a hairbrush through her tangled hair. Looking at her own white face in the mirror, she tried not to wonder if she still looked like the sister Nate remembered. Tried not to imagine how she might have changed. Finished, she hurried out into the corridor and nearly walked directly into Will, who was leaning against the corridor wall opposite her door, examining his nails. With his usual disregard for manners, he was in shirt sleeves, and over the shirt was a series of leather straps crisscrossing his chest. Across his back hung a long, thin blade. She could see the hilt of it just over his shoulder. Thrust through his belt were several long, thin, white serif blades. Jessamine's voice echoed in Tessa's head.
You think I haven't seen you looking at Will with puppy dog eyes?
The witch light was burning low. Tessa hoped it was too dim in the corridor for him to see her blush. I thought you weren't going with the Enclave tonight, she said finally, more to have something to say than anything else. I'm not. I'm bringing these down to Charlotte and Henry in the courtyard. Benedict Lightwood is sending his carriage for them. It's faster. It should be here shortly. It was dark in the corridor, dark enough that though Tessa thought that Will was smiling, she wasn't sure.
Concerned about my safety, are you? Or had you planned to gift me with a favor so I could wear it into the battle like Wilfred of Ivanhoe?
I never liked that book, Tessa said. Rowena was such a ninny. Ivanhoe should have chosen Rebecca.
The dark-haired girl, not the blonde, really.
Now she was almost sure he was smiling.
Will?
Yes?
Do you think the Enclave will actually manage to kill him? De Quincey, that is?
Yes, he spoke without hesitation. The time for negotiation has passed. If you've ever seen terriers in a rat-baiting pit, well, I don't suppose you would have, but that's what it will be like tonight.
The Clave will dispatch the vampires one by one until they're wiped out utterly.
You mean there will be no more vampires in London?
Will shrugged. There are always vampires, but De Quincey's clan will be gone. And once it's over, once the Magister is gone, I suppose there will be no more reason for Nate and me to stay in the Institute, will there?
Will seemed genuinely taken aback. I suppose...
Yes, well, that's true. I imagine that you would prefer to stay in a less violent locale. Perhaps you could even see some of the nicer parts of London, Westminster Abbey.
I would prefer to go home, Tessa said, to New York.
Will said nothing. The witchlight in the corridor had faded. In the shadows, she couldn't clearly see his face.
Unless there were a reason for me to stay, she went on, half wondering what she herself even meant by that.
It was easier to talk to Will like this when she couldn't see his face, and could only sense his presence near hers in the dark corridor. She didn't see him move, but she felt his fingers touch the back of her hand lightly.
Tessa, he said, please don't worry. Soon it will all be settled.
Her heart thumped painfully against her ribs. Soon what would be settled? He couldn't mean what she thought he did. He had to mean something else.
Don't you wish to go home?
He didn't move, his fingers still brushing her hand. I can't ever go home.
But why not? She whispered.
But it was too late. She felt him retreating from her. His hand drew back from hers. I know your parents came to the Institute when you were 12 and you refused to see them. Why? What did they do to you that was so dreadful?
They did nothing. He shook his head. I must go. Henry and Charlotte are waiting.
Will, she said, but he was already walking away, a slim dark shadow moving toward the stairs.
Will, she called after him. Will, who is Cecily?
But he was already gone. By the time Tessa returned to the drawing room, Nate and Jessamine were there and the sun had begun to set. She went immediately to the window and looked out. In the courtyard below, Jem, Henry, Will, and Charlotte were gathered, their shadows cast long and dark across the Institute steps. Henry was putting a last Eratzi rune on his arm, while Charlotte seemed to be giving Jem and Will instructions. Jem was nodding, but Tessa could tell, even at this distance, that Will, whose arms were crossed over his chest, was being recalcitrant. He wants to go with them, she thought. He doesn't want to stay here. Jem probably wanted to go as well, but he wouldn't complain about it. That was the difference between the two boys. One of the differences, at any rate.
Tessie, are you sure you don't want to play?
Nate turned to look at his sister. He was back in his armchair, a rug over his legs, cards laid out on a small table between him and Jessamine beside a silver tea service and a small plate of sandwiches. His hair looked slightly damp, as if he had washed it, and he was wearing Jem's clothes. Nathaniel had lost weight, Tessa could tell, but Jem was slender enough that his shirt was still a little tight on Nate at the collar and cuffs. Though Jem's shoulders were still broader, and Nate looked a little slighter of frame in Jem's jacket. Tessa was still looking out the window. A great black carriage had drawn up, with a design on the door of two burning torches, and Henry and Charlotte were getting into it. Will and Jem had vanished from view.
"She's sure," Jessamine sniffed when Tessa didn't answer. "Just look at her. She looks so disapproving."
Tessa tore her gaze from the window. "I'm not disapproving. It just seems wrong to play games while Henry and Charlotte and others are out risking their lives."
"Yes, I know you said that before."
Jessamine set her cards down.
"Really, Tessa, this happens all the time. They go off to battle, they come back. There's nothing worth getting worked up over."
Tessa bit her lip. "I feel I ought to have said goodbye or good luck, but with all the rushing about..."
"You needn't worry," Jem said, coming into the drawing room, Will just behind him. "Shadow hunters don't say goodbye, not before a battle, or good luck. You must behave as if return is certain, not a matter of chance." We don't require luck, said Will, throwing himself into a chair beside Jessamine, who shot him an angry look. We have a heavenly mandate, after all. With God on your side, what does luck matter? He sounded surprisingly bitter.
Oh, stop being so depressing, Will, said Jessamine. We're playing cards. You can either join the game or be quiet.
Will raised an eyebrow. What are you playing?
Pope Joan, said Jessamine coolly, dealing out cards. I was just explaining the rules to Mr. Gray.
Miss Lovelace says you win by ridding yourself of all your cards. That seems backward to me. Nate grinned across the table at Jessamine, who dimpled annoyingly. Will poked at the steaming cup that sat beside Nathaniel's elbow.
Is there any tea in this? He inquired. Or is it simply pure brandy?
Nate flushed.
Brandy is restorative.
Yes, said Jem, a little edge to his voice. It often restores men right to the poorhouse.
Really? The two of you, such hypocrites. It isn't as if Will doesn't drink, and Jem...
Jessamine broke off, biting her lip.
You two are just fussing because Henry and Charlotte wouldn't take you along with them, she said finally. Because you're too young.
She smiled at Nate across the table.
I prefer the company of a more mature gentleman myself.
Nate, Tessa thought disgustedly, is exactly 2 years older than Will. Hardly a century. Nor is he by any stretch of the imagination mature. But before she could say anything, a great echoing boom sounded through the institute. Nate raised his eyebrows. I thought this wasn't a real church. I thought there were no bells. There aren't. That sound isn't church bells ringing. Will rose to his feet. That's the summoning bell. It means someone is downstairs and demands conference with the Shadow Hunters. And since James and I are the only ones here... He looked at Jessamine, and Tessa realized he was waiting for Jessamine to contradict him, to say that she was a Shadow Hunter too, but Jessamine was smiling at Nate, and he was leaning in to say something in her ear. Neither of them was paying attention to what else was going on in the room. Jem looked at Will and shook his head. They both turned toward the door. As they went out, Jem looked at Tessa and gave her a little shrug.
I wish you were a Shadow Hunter, she thought his eyes were saying, but maybe it was simply what she hoped they were saying.
Perhaps he was merely smiling at her kindly, and there was no meaning in it. Nate poured himself another hot water and brandy. He and Jessamine had abandoned the pretense that they were playing cards and were leaning close to each other, murmuring in low voices. Tessa felt a dull thump of disappointment. Somehow she had expected that Nate's ordeal would have made him more thoughtful, more inclined to understand that there were larger things at work in the world, more important things than his own immediate pleasures. She expected nothing better of Jessamine, but what had once seemed charming in Nate now grated on her nerves in a way that surprised her. She leaned toward the window again. There was a carriage in the courtyard. Will and Jem were on the front steps. With them was a man in evening dress, elegant black tailcoat, high silk hat, a white waistcoat that shone under the witch-light torches. He looked like a mundane to Tessa, though at this distance it was difficult to tell. As she watched, he raised his arms and made a broad gesture. She saw Will look at Jem, and Jem nod, and wondered what on earth they were talking about. She looked past the man to the coach behind him, and froze. Instead of a coat of arms, the name of a business enterprise was painted across one of the doors. Mortmain and Company. Mortmain? The man her father had worked for, whom Nathaniel had blackmailed, who had introduced her brother to the Shadow World. What was he doing here? She looked at Nate again, her feeling of annoyance washed away by a wave of protectiveness.
If he knew Mortmain was here, he would doubtless be upset. It would be better if she found out what was going on before he did.
She slid off the windowsill and made her way quietly to the door. Deep in conversation with Jessamine, Nate hardly seemed to notice as she left the room. It was surprisingly easy for Tessa to find her way to the huge stone-bound spiral stairway that speared through the center of the institute.
She must have been learning her way around the place at last, she decided as she made her way down the steps to the ground floor, and found Thomas standing in the entryway. He was holding a massive sword, point down, his face very serious. Behind him, the massive double doors of the Institute were open on a rectangle of blue-black London twilight, lit by the blaze of the courtyard's witch-light torches. He looked taken aback at the sight of Tessa.
"Miss Gray?"
She pitched her voice low. "What's going on out there, Thomas?" He shrugged.
"Mr. Mortmain," he said. "He wanted to speak with Mr. and Mrs. Bramwell, but since they're not here..."
Tessa started toward the door. Thomas, startled, moved to prevent her.
"Miss Gray, I don't think..."
"You'll have to use that sword on me to stop me, Thomas," Tessa said in a cold voice, and Thomas, after a moment's hesitation, moved aside. Tessa, with a twinge, hoped she hadn't hurt his feelings, but he looked more astonished than anything else. She moved past him onto the steps outside the Institute where Will and Jem were standing. A hard breeze was coming up, ruffling her hair and making her shiver. At the foot of the stairs stood the man she had seen from the window. He was shorter than she would have imagined, small and wiry-looking, with a tanned, friendly face beneath the brim of his tall hat. Despite the elegance of his clothes, he had the bluff, natural bearing of a sailor or tradesman.
"Yes," he was saying. "Mr. and Mrs. Branwell were kind enough to call on me last week, and were even kinder, I understand, in keeping our meeting something of a secret." "They didn't tell the Enclave about your occult experimentations, if that's what you mean," Will said a bit shortly.
Mortmain reddened.
"Yes, it was a favor. And I thought to return the favor in kind," he broke off, looking past Will at Tessa. "And who is this? Another shadow hunter?"
Will and Jem both turned at the same time and saw Tessa. Jem looked pleased to see her. Will, of course, looked exasperated and perhaps a touch amused.
"Tessa," he said, "couldn't keep your nose out, could you?"
He turned back to Mortmain.
"This is Miss Gray, of course, Nathaniel Gray's sister."
Mortmain looked appalled.
"Oh, good God, I should have realized. You look like him. Miss Gray."
"I don't think she does, actually," Will said, but rather quietly, so Tessa doubted Mortmain could hear him.
"You can't see Nate," Tessa said. "I don't know if that's why you've come here, Mr. Mortmain, but he isn't well enough. He needs to recover from his ordeal, not be reminded of it."
The lines deepened at the corners of Mortmain's mouth.
"I'm not here to see the boy," he said. "I recognize that I failed him abominably. Mrs. Branwell made that clear."
"You should have looked for him," Tessa said. "My brother. You let him sink into the shadow world without a trace." Some small part of Tessa's mind was amazed she was being so bold, but she went on regardless. "When he told you he'd gone to work for De Quincey, you should have done something. You knew what kind of man De Quincey was, if you can even call him a man."
"I know." Mortmain looked gray beneath his hat. "That is why I'm here, to try to make up for what I've done."
"And how do you propose to do that?" asked Jem in his clear, strong voice. "And why now?" Mortmain looked at Tessa.
"Your parents," he said, "were good, kind people. I have always regretted introducing them to the shadow world. At the time I thought it all a delightful game and a bit of a joke. I have learned otherwise since. To assuage the guilt I will tell you what I know, even if it means I must flee England to escape De Quincey's wrath."
He sighed.
"Some time ago, De Quincey ordered from me a number of mechanical parts, cogs, cams, gears, and the like. I never asked what he needed them for. One does not inquire such things of the Magister. Only when you Nephilim came to see me did it occur to me that his need for them might be connected to a nefarious purpose. I investigated, and an informant within the club told me that De Quincey intended to build an army of mechanical monsters meant to destroy the ranks of shadow hunters." He shook his head. De Quincey and his ilk may despise shadow hunters, but I do not. I am only a human man. I know they're all that stand between me and a world in which I and my kind are the playthings of demons. I cannot stand behind what De Quincey is doing.
That is all very well, Will said, a hint of impatience in his voice. But you're not telling us anything we do not already know.
Did you also know, Mortmain said, that he paid a pair of warlocks called the Dark Sisters to create a binding spell that would animate these creatures not with mechanics but with demonic energies?
We did, said Jem. Though I believe there is only one Dark Sister remaining, Will destroyed the other one.
But a sister brought her back via a necromantic charm, said Mortmain, a hint of triumph in his tone, as if he were relieved to at last have a piece of information that they did not. Even now, the two of them are ensconced in a mansion in Highgate. It used to belong to a warlock until De Quincey had him killed, working on the binding spell. If my sources are correct, the Dark Sisters will attempt to implement the spell tonight.
Will's blue eyes were dark and thoughtful.
Thank you for the information, he said. But De Quincey will soon be no more of a threat to us, or his mechanical monsters either.
Mortman's eyes widened.
Is the Clave to move against the Magister tonight?
Goodness, said Will. You really do know all the terms, don't you? It's very disconcerting in a mundane. He smiled pleasantly.
You mean you're not going to tell me, said Mortmain ruefully. I suppose you wouldn't. But you should know that De Quincey has at his disposal hundreds of those clockwork creatures. An army. The moment the Dark Sisters work their spell, the army will rise and join with De Quincey. If the Enclave is to defeat him, it would be wise to ensure that that army does not rise, or they will be nearly impossible to defeat.
Are you aware of the Dark Sisters' location beyond the fact that it is in Highgate? Asked Jem.
Mortmain nodded. Most certainly, he said, and rattled off a street name and house number.
Will nodded.
Well, we'll certainly take all this under advisement, thank you.
Indeed, said Jem. Good evening, Mr. Mortmain.
But,
Mortmain looked taken aback,
are you going to do something about what I've told you or not?
I said we'd take it under advisement, Will told him.
As for you, Mr. Mortmain, you look like a man with somewhere to be.
What? Mortmain glanced down at his evening dress and chuckled.
I suppose so. It's just, if the Magister finds out that I've told you all this, my life could be in danger.
Then perhaps it is time for a holiday, Jem suggested. I've heard Italy is very pleasant this time of year.
Mortmain looked from Will to Jem and back again and then seemed to give up.
His shoulders sagged. He raised his eyes to Tessa. If you could pass along my apologies to your brother.
I don't think so, Tessa said. But thank you, Mr. Mortmain.
After a long pause, he nodded, then turned away. The three of them watched as he climbed back into his carriage. The sound of the horse's hooves was loud in the courtyard as the carriage pulled away and rattled through the Institute gates.
What are you going to do? Tessa asked the moment the carriage was out of sight. About the Dark Sisters.
Go after them, of course.
Will's color was high, his eyes glittering.
Your brother said De Quincey had dozens of those creatures at his disposal. Mortmain says there are hundreds. If Mortmain's correct, we must get to the Dark Sisters before they work their spell, or the Enclave may well be walking into a slaughter.
But perhaps it would be better to warn Henry and Charlotte and the others.
How? Will managed to make the one word sound cutting. I suppose we could send Thomas to warn the Enclave, but there's no guarantee he would get there in time, and if the Dark Sisters managed to raise the army, he could simply be killed with the rest. No, we must manage the Dark Sisters on our own. I killed one of them before. Jem and I ought to be able to manage too.
But perhaps Mortmain is wrong, Tessa said. You have only his word. He might have faulty information.
He might, Jem acknowledged. But can you imagine if he doesn't? And we ignored him?
The consequence to the Enclave could be utter destruction.
Tessa, knowing he was right, felt her heart sink.
Maybe I could help,
I fought the Dark Sisters with you once before. If I could accompany you...
No, Will said. It's out of the question. We have so little time to prepare that we must rely on our fighting experience, and you have none.
I fought off De Quincey at the party.
I said no. Will's tone was final.
Tessa looked at Jem, but he gave only an apologetic shrug as if to say that he was sorry, but Will was right. She turned her gaze back to Will.
But what about Boadicea?
For a moment she thought he'd forgotten what he'd said to her in the library. Then the glimmer of a smile tugged at the corner of his mouth, as if he'd tried to fight it and couldn't.
You will be Boadicea someday, Tessa, he said. But not tonight.
He turned to Jem.
We ought to get Thomas and tell him to ready the carriage. Highgate's not close. We'd best get started.
Full night had descended on the city by the time Will and Jem stood out by the carriage, preparing to depart. Thomas was checking the fastenings on the horses, while Will, his steely, a white flash in the dimness, scrawled a mark on Jem's bare forearm. Tessa, having registered her disapproval, stood on the steps and watched them, a hollow feeling in her stomach. After satisfying himself that the harnesses were secure, Thomas turned and ran lightly up the steps, stopping when Tessa raised a hand to halt him.
"Are they going now?" she asked.
"Is that all?"
He nodded.
"All ready to go, miss."
He had tried to get Jem and Will to take him along, but Will was concerned that Charlotte would be angry at Thomas for participating in their exploit and had told him not to come.
"Besides," Will had said, "we ought to have a man in the house, someone to protect the Institute while we're gone. Nathaniel doesn't count," he'd added with a sideways glance at Tessa, who had ignored him.
Will slid Jem's sleeve down, covering the marks he had made. As he returned his steely to his pocket, Jem stood looking up at him. Their faces were pale smudges in the torchlight. Tessa raised her hand, then lowered it slowly.
What was it he had said?
"Shadow hunters don't say goodbye, not before a battle, or good luck. You must behave as if return is certain, not a matter of chance." The boys, as if alerted by her gesture, looked up toward her. She thought she could see the blue of Will's eyes, even from where she stood. He wore a strange look as their eyes locked, the look of someone who has just woken up and wonders if what they are looking at is real or a dream. It was Jem who broke away and ran up the stairs to her. As he reached her, she saw that he had high color in his face and his eyes were bright and hot. She wondered how much of the drug Will had let him take, so that he would be ready to fight.
"Tessa," he said.
"I didn't mean to say goodbye," she said quickly, "but it seems odd to let you leave without saying anything at all." He looked at her curiously. He did something that surprised her then, and took her hand, turning it over. She looked down at it, at her bitten fingernails, the still healing scratches along the backs of her fingers. He kissed the back of it, just a light touch of his mouth, and his hair, as soft and light as silk, brushed her wrist as he lowered his head. She felt a shock go through her, strong enough to startle her, and she stood speechless as he straightened, his mouth curving into a smile.
"Mizpah," he said.
She blinked at him a little dazed.
"What?"
"A sort of goodbye without saying goodbye," he said. "It is a reference to a passage in the Bible.
And Mizpah, for he said, 'The Lord watch between me and thee when we are absent from one another.'"
There was no chance for Tessa to say anything in response, for he had turned and run down the steps to join Will, who was as motionless as a statue, his face upturned at the foot of the steps. His hands, sheathed in black gloves, were in fists at his sides, Tessa thought, but perhaps it was a trick of the light, for when Jem reached him and touched him on the shoulder, he turned with a laugh, and without another look at Tessa, he swung himself up into the driver's seat, Jem following him. He cracked the whip, and the carriage rattled through the gate, which slammed shut behind it as if pushed by invisible hands. Tessa heard the lock catch, a hard click in the silence,
and then the sound of church bells ringing somewhere in the city. Sophie and Agatha were waiting in the entryway for Tessa when she came back inside. Agatha was saying something to Sophie, but Sophie didn't appear to be listening. She looked over at Tessa when she came in, and something about the way she looked for a moment reminded Tessa of the way Will had looked at her in the courtyard. But that was ridiculous. There were no two people in the world more unalike than Sophie and Will. Tessa stepped aside as Agatha went to close the great heavy double doors. She had just pushed them shut, panting slightly, when the knob of the leftmost door, untouched, began to turn. Sophie frowned. They can't be back so soon, can they? Agatha gazed down, perplexed at the turning knob, her hands still braced against the door, then stood back as the door swung wide before her. A figure stood on the doorstep, backlit by the light outside. For a moment, all Tessa could tell was that he was tall and clad in a frayed jacket. Agatha, her head tipping back as she gazed upward, said in a startled voice, "Oh, my lord!" The figure moved. Light flashed on metal. Agatha screamed and staggered. She seemed to be trying to back away from the stranger, but something was preventing her. "Dear God in heaven," Sophie whispered, "what is that?" For a moment, Tessa saw the whole scene frozen as if it were a painting. The open door, the clockwork automaton, the one with the stripped bare hands, still in the same worn gray jacket. And still, dear God, with Jem's blood on its hands, dried red-black on the dull gray flesh, and the strips of copper showing through where the skin had been scraped or pulled away. One blood-stained hand gripped Agatha's wrist. Clamped in the other was a long, thin knife. Tessa moved forward, but it was already too late. The creature swung the blade with blinding speed and buried it in Agatha's chest. Agatha choked, her hands going to the blade. The creature stood, ragged and terrifying and unmoving as she clawed at the knife hilt. Then, with appalling swiftness, it yanked the blade back, letting her crumple to the ground. Nor did the automaton remain to watch her fall, but turned and walked back out the door through which it had come. Galvanized, Sophie screamed, "Agatha!" and ran to her side. Tessa dashed to the door. The clockwork creature was walking down the steps into the empty courtyard. She stared after it. What on earth had it come for, and why was it leaving now? But there was no time to dwell on that. She reached for the rope of the summoning bell and pulled it, hard. As the sound clanged through the building, she slammed the door shut, dropping the lock bar into place, then turned to help Sophie. Together they managed to lift Agatha and half-carry, half-drag her across the room, where they fell to their knees beside her. Sophie, ripping strips of fabric from her white apron and pressing them over Agatha's wound, said in a tone of wild panic, "I don't understand, miss. Nothing should be able to touch that door. None but one with Shadow Hunter blood should be able to turn the doorknob." But he had Shadow Hunter blood, Tessa thought with a sudden horror. Jem's blood, staining its metal hands like paint. Could that be why it had bent over Jem that night after the bridge? Could that be why it had fled once it had gotten what it wanted, his blood? And didn't that mean it could come back whenever it wanted? She began to rise to her feet, but it was already too late. The bar that held the door closed cracked with a noise like a gunshot and tumbled to the ground in two pieces. Sophie looked up and screamed again, though she didn't move away from Agatha as the door burst open, a window onto the night. The steps of the Institute were no longer empty. They were teeming, but not with people. Clockwork monsters swarmed up them, their movements jerky, their faces blank and staring. They were not quite like the ones Tessa had seen before. Some looked as though they had been put together so hastily that they had no faces at all, just smooth ovals of metal patched here and there with uneven bits of human skin. Even more horrible, quite a few of them had bits of machinery in place of arms.